The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm joined by the people that have been on the podcast more than anyone else. They've set a record for it. It is our favorite winemakers, whether it's in Okanagan, Ontario, or today, Argentina. It is Ann Sperling. It is Peter Gamble. Ann, so nice to see you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Peter, good to see you as well.
Absolutely a pleasure.
Now, what people need to know is that you guys, who are great when it comes to promoting, great when it comes to talking, you almost feel like you're afraid of the mic. Like neither one of you wanted to pick it up first. But let's just start with the obvious. Tell people about, I think a lot of people that listen to this podcast, they know you guys from all the work you do in Niagara, but you have got a release coming out for Sado. Peter, we'll start with you. Please explain to people the wine that's going to be released to the LCBO.
Okay, so we've got the 2018 coming, and it's the Versado Malbec. So they're all off the same property. You know about it.
Yep.
It's all ancient vines. It's a 1920 planting, so it's now more than, 100 years old. And although the 18 would be 2 years less than that, and than 100. And this is the white label, the one that's most familiar to buyers at the LCBO. It's been there for 15 years or thereabouts now, and so something we're very proud of. It's got a lot of character, a lot of depth. The LCBO has it at $21.95, which is a painful price for us to do it at. The story behind that, man, is that when we first got the vineyard, it took some while to bring it up to speed to the standards that Ann and I like to see in a vineyard, and at the quality level that we like to see. And it had had a couple of years of hail prior to our buying it, so there was some damage in the vineyard. And it takes a while to bring it around from that. You could still get the same quality fruit, but it takes a couple of years to get there. And so we did a lot of work on the vineyard, and we had an introductory price that we had at the LCBO. And they ordered so much of it every year that even though the vineyard now is in much better condition throughout, and this wine is worth significantly more than that, it's hard for us to just turn down that order on an annual basis. And so we have. So we've accepted the order, and it's just a wonderful wine. You'll love it. It's at a great price.
Yeah. Well, first off, $21.95 for a hand-picked wine made from vines that are like 100 years old. That's a pretty damn good value. Let's talk about the vines for a second, because it's something doing my research on it. For people who don't know, what are the advantages of having vines of this age in terms of consistent quality of the wine?
A big thing that's really fascinating about this particular planting of Malbec is not just that it's 100 years old, which is like amazing and, something that we don't expect to see in our lifetime in Canada, right? With vineyards of that age. If you go back in time to what was happening in the wine world then, there's, for example, these vines are on their own roots. So in, all of the New World and in all of Europe, vines are planted on rootstock because of phylloxera. But in Argentina, they've managed to keep it out. And there's a few, tiny pockets around the world that are like that. So this is 100%, vinifera DNA, right? Whereas like all rootstocks also have North American DNA in them. So that's really interesting. It was like before clones were a thing. So this is, a massal planting. So not every vine is exactly the same as the next one. So it's still Malbec, but there's slightly different traits from vine to vine. And then because the vines are so old, they're like super adapted to the place that they're in. Over time, if a vine dies, for example, we can take a cane from the neighboring vine, a mother plant, and we bury it partially, keep it attached to the mother. It's called layering, and it'll grow roots, and you'll have a new vine. But over 100 years of time, there's certain ones that kind of dominate that process, right? So the vines are really, unique to the site. They're unique to anything else, even in the neighborhood. So it's a really special wine that way.
The one of the things I wanted to point out was that there's a group now of young producers, young Argentine producers that are winemakers, making wines that are really emphatic about the difference of the wines, you know, particularly the Malbec, that are made from let's call it pre-phylloxera, because it's not. I mean, it's post-phylloxera, but it's all a result of that importation of the vines that came as a result of phylloxera in Europe, where they came in. And these old vines on their own rootstocks are almost an insisted part of what they like to see at the very top level in wine production. So they're very emphatic about having ungrafted vines for the production of the wine. They feel that it's the truest and most transparent expression of Malbec when you don't have to have it on a rootstock from a North American grape variety.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, you are getting the purest expression. There's nothing sort of cluttering it or filtering anything out. And also, there must be something interesting knowing that some of these vines, so these things have been planted since the First World War was going on. I mean, there is a sort of historic gravitas to that as well.
Well, the other thing that was happening historically, and, you know, earlier before we turned the mics on, we were talking about, you know, the Buenos Aires and the kind of stature that has in South America in the 1920s and pre-1930s, right, pre-depression, the people in Argentina had the fifth most wealthy economy in the world. So, you know, we don't think about Argentina in that way today, but people had money and they had stature and they wanted to enjoy all the best things in life, including great food and wine, you know, coming from their European heritage and all of that, their great food culture. And so the vineyard plantings reflected that. This vineyard was planted to make great wine. You know, and later in Argentina's history, when there was, you know, sanctions, you know, because it was a military dictatorship and all these things, the wine was for domestic consumption. So the vineyards that were planted in the 50s and 60s and 70s, those are, you know, by our standards, those are very old vines, but they were planted for productivity and domestic consumption.
Not for quality. Right. Yeah. Just make as much of it.
Fine winemaking. So that's, you know, that's the other thing that's really fascinating about this vineyard.
So the wine that we're drinking now is a 10-year-old version, is 10-year-old Reserva of your Vesado, correct?
Yes, that's right. For, you know, the release that Peter was mentioning is 2018, and it's our introductory kind of tier, whereas we brought for you, because, you know, why not, a 2014 Reserva. So in our, even though everything's coming from this one small 7-acre vineyard, we do a lot of selection. So at the pre-harvest, Peter and I are walking every row, tasting all the berries and looking at the vines and sort of how they've grown through the season, how they're carrying the crop, how the berries look in terms of size and density and flavor profile. And then we have our pickers actually select through the vineyard and take some grapes for the white label tier and some for our Reserva tier. And those become separate fermentations and then separate, you know, barrel aging regime. And then we go through and we select again. So the Reserva wine, this 2014 that we're tasting, those barrels were selected for their ageability.
Right.
So tasting a 10-year-old, you know, seems only fitting, but we select those barrels for their structure, elegance, and, you know, potential for aging.
Yeah, just perfumed. It's like this very, I want to say elegant, but there's a lot of power on the mid. I think I get confused and think it was like a heavier Spanish Grenache, just with some of the spicy, some of the red fruit notes that I'm getting. That wine is wonderful. Before we talk more, I thought about this. When you guys are going through the rows, what are you looking for where you realize, okay, these grapes are Reserva, these grapes are more for the entry level? What is it? What is the plan of attack?
Well, a lot of times we're looking for small berries. Small berries will usually indicate that you're going to have more skin contact in relation to the amount of juice. So you're getting a higher percentage of the colors and the tannins that are coming from the skins as opposed to from the pulp and the juice inside. So that's one important factor. Another one is to look the nature of the tannins, which you can tell bizarrely by rubbing the skins between your thumb and your index finger. You can see the amount of staining than it does on your fingers. And those that have more staining on your fingers will indicate that, you know, the presence of a greater certain chemical contributions and tannin contributions that contribute to the depth and the intensity of the wine, and also add to the longevity of the wine as well. Those are the major factors. We end up actually, man, we put ribbons through. So like we don't just go through and taste. We end up with ribbons in every row that indicate which sections we want picked for, you know, which cuvee. And that will vary from year to year. There could be as many as three different picks for that as well.
How long does that take you guys to do?
Usually we can accomplish that in 2 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
By the way, do you count your steps? Like, please tell me you have an Apple Watch or something on. So it's like we did 29,000 steps today.
Yeah, no. It's 7 acres, so we'll be okay. It pales in comparison to mountain hikes, you know? So we're fine to do that. And it takes some time, you know, because you're going through tasting. It's probably harder on the jaws, you know, than it is on the feet.
What is it about this location where the grapes are sourced from? For Versado, what is it about this location? Because the one thing with you guys are definitely location junkies. Like, you know, we know from our last interview at Daubin Estate, you know, you guys are attuned to that. What was it about this area that, you know, that attracted you?
Okay, so this one will blow you away. We loved Mendoza, and we liked the characteristics and the traits. We weren't that fond, and we loved the taste of the grape, and we weren't that fond with some of the wines that were being made. We felt that a lot of the new international consultants were coming in and making chocolate bars, you know, like too heavy, too intense, too rich, too sweet, reverse osmosis to bring the concentration up, like really massive, you know, Michel Roland was a huge influence, Paul Hubbs a huge influence, a number of internationals came in, and you know, the big heavy massive style was a heavy player, late harvested to the point often that the skins are beginning to shrivel a tiny bit on the grapes, so really late and really, really ripe and overly alcoholic, and so we just felt it was a more interesting grape variety than that, and that methodology didn't work well for us. But we looked at over 230 vineyards before we bought this one, and so many would have been narrowed down, you know, quite quickly. You know, it's not the area we prefer. We had three consultants looking at vineyards for us there, including, you know, two of the best in the country in terms of viticulturists, and knew what we were after. It took us, we bought the house almost instantly, but decided right away that we couldn't find a house of the quality we wanted and a vineyard of the quality we wanted on the same site. So we just bought the house, continued for another 2 years almost before we actually bought the vineyard in question.
Was that frustrating? Because Amy, my girlfriend, and I, we got frustrated looking to find the right dining room chairs. Contentious.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I mean, first we were viewed as fanatics by our team down there. In fact, I think toward the end of that, they were starting to think they're not really going to buy anything. Like we'd get it down, and then we'd get soil analysis. If it got close, we'd get soil analysis done. We'd look at soil analysis, and you know, this isn't perfect, or this is a little too, a little too intense, a little too. You know, too much humus, it'll grow too much. We want smaller crops and real intensity. And then when we got very close, if the vineyard looked like, this could be a contender, then we'd search out the winemakers that had made the wine from that property to see if any were still in barrels unblended by themselves so we could taste those. And so we went through all of these steps and finally found in an area that had earlier been identified by a couple of our consultants there as the sweet spot that combined age, you know, 100-year-old plus vines, and also combined high altitude, so your alcohols are a little lower, a little brighter wine, and depth of character, and so literally right in the area in question, and that's Cobos Road, one of the most legendary roads in Argentina for classic old Malbec.
How much bad Malbec is there in Ontario? Because I will tell you right now, I don't have the best impression of Malbec. I have very little of it in my cellars. And at a certain point, I'm like, no, there's so much wonderful wine that I have easy access to. And maybe this is my fault. Maybe I got lazy and got discouraged. But it feels like there is a lot of bad Argentinian Malbec in Ontario.
Okay, I love that you say that. When we present a lot of times at restaurants and with sommeliers, A lot of times there's some hesitation, you know, because people are used to inexpensive Malbec that's often made for the bulk market. The LCBO, especially on the general list items, are not looking for, you know, the top-end wines. And very many of them are of a style because people have begun to expect, you know, sort of sweet, sort of thick, sort of alcoholic and heavy and often a bit clumsy. We like the opposite from the point of view of winemaking. We don't like to slather things with new oak. And so, as well. So we have some tell us, for example, that oh wow, this is really good. I have to recalibrate. You know, this isn't what I was expecting of Argentine Malbec. And you know, we tell the story and tell about, you know, choosing the high elevations and doing more delicate winemaking. And it's a big part of, you know, what we do. So your impressions are true. And even at the very top end, there were some of those producers, you know, that I mentioned, where you've got the big international consultants, you're going for the big $150 bottles, and you're just making it as big as you possibly can, as massive, usually a little bit sweet, and often concentrated with reverse osmosis. So this is an elegant, natural wine, organically grown.
I like that you said elegant. I'm changing my mind a little bit. I know I threw out, early on, I was getting some of this high-end Spanish Grenache. I was getting a little bit of note, then I retasted it. I'm like, Cos, what are you doing? Because it does have a little bit more of the dark fruit, the plum. I'm talking about the 10-year-old bottle. This is powerful elegance, is how I'm going to describe this wine. This would be a wine if I was at, say, Blue Blood, if I was at a high-end steak joint, but I didn't want to spend the $400 on the Napa or the Bordeaux. This wine here would go perfect with any cut of red meat. That's a great wine. How would you guys? And unfortunately, no, you're holding the mic. You keep passing it away. How would you describe the wine that we are drinking right now?
Well, I love your description of it. I don't just reserve this wine for, you know, the big steak night, because I think Malbec is amazingly versatile. There's such balance between, you know, you get that dark color, which is maybe a bit deceiving, but Malbec has a lot of color as a grape. But from a tannin perspective, it's not as tannic as, say, Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yep.
And so you can have a silkier wine from Malbec. It can fit with some braises. It can fit with, you know, a variety of cuts of meat. And, you know, you think about things like an Argentine asado, you start with sausages. You know, you've got that fattiness and all of those rich flavors and spiciness often. And then you move to some, you know, a variety of cuts of meat, some with bones and, you know, some without, and you sort of finish with the fillet kind of cuts, right? But really, you know, Malbec can go with a lot of things. And, you know, I'm always pushing Peter, we got to try it with some fish, you know, we got to try it, because, you know, I just want to push that versatility aspect.
What made you guys first get into Mendoza? What was it that first attracted you to that area? I mean, obviously, it's a famous area, so the answer might be as simple as that, but I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think a variety of things. You know, timing was a factor. It was, you know, a place that Peter had visited. I was scheduled to go on a winemaking consultation learning trip there. And so that kind of, you know, congealed our travel there. But it's a beautiful place. The economy was at a time when, you know, it made sense to look at investing there. Land prices still are very approachable, and, you know, vineyard prices, but the history of winemaking is amazing. There's, you know, there are some really great vineyard sites. I mean, it's a huge wine growing region. And yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of wine at every quality level that's made. And, you know, sadly, we don't see all the greatest ones here. But so, you know, the potential was there, and the investment potential was there. So I think, you know, when you think about that, we looked at 230 vineyards, it wasn't about, you know, let's make an economic decision here. This was like geeking out at the highest level.
Of course. Well, that's what you guys are. And I mean that as the highest compliment. By the way, just for anyone listening, if they're thinking of getting the Versado, you find me a wine that's $21.95, where the winemakers went through 230 vineyards to find just the right one. And it's 100-year-old vines, and it's handpicked. It's a pretty good combination. All right, well, let's stick with the theme of nerdy. What would you say to people are the biggest differences between good Mendoza Malbec and Cahors, because those are obviously your two ancestral homes for the grape.
Yeah, Cahors. So the grape has modified and transformed to a certain extent over the period of time, you know, that it spends in different climates. And so the Cot, or Co, C-O-T, the classic Malbec out of Cahors, out of the southwest of France, is still available. In fact, you can get it at nurseries, if you so choose, French nurseries, Mercier especially, in Argentina. And so we've seen them grow side by side. And even in the same vineyard side by side, the grape variety, as it's evolved through, you know, a century, century and a half in Argentina, has become much different. That's one thing. The other thing that's really, really critical is those that know Bordeaux really well will know that around the time of the 1855 classification in Bordeaux, when they determined which were the first growths, which were the second growths, which were the third, Malbec was a way more prominent grape variety.
Yep.
And then when you came into phylloxera in the late 1800s, 1870 through 1890, in that general area, you had removal of all of those grape varieties dying, a lot of them, during that period, and decisions by the wineries to replant grape varieties. The reason they didn't replant Malbec as prominently as it was prior to that, at the times when Bordeaux were being assessed and classified, was that it was a difficult grape when you had rain in the harvest. And so rain in the fall, it really hurts. So the reason for that is the berries are very thin-skinned, and they're a slip skin. If anyone who eats grapes noticed that, for example, on Concords and a lot of table grapes that you get out of Canada, specifically Labruscas, if you pinch them as you chew them, the pulp will shoot out and the skin stays behind. That's a slip skin. And what happens is there's a layer of juice around the outside of the pulp, between the pulp and the skin. And when you get rain in the fall, when the skins are getting ripe, the rain will permeate through that very thin skin in Malbec and dilute the grape variety. And so what happens is it makes it more susceptible to mildew and disease at that point, and also dilutes the wine. So Bordeaux made the right decision, I think, within the context of the region, and planted with higher amounts of thicker skin, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, which are resistant to that and don't object to the rains that they get. In Argentina, there's very, very few rains. Anne and I used to joke, because we'd come down when we were doing catch up in the spring and we're down to see, you know, how things are going, or in the fall, and we're down to see how things were going. We talked to all the viticulturists we knew, and it was hilarious because everybody would start their conversation the same. Oh, you know, it's been a really good year. We had that one rain back on February 4th. And whatever, they'd remember the day it might have rained. You know, like, that's how little rain there is. And it's so infrequently relates to harvest time. That's changing a little bit, but it gives you an indication. So it's a great place to grow the variety. The variety has evolved over that period of time. So a number of different things differentiate it, Matt, from what's happening in Cahors.
And if you were doing a blind tasting, and some really mean person, you were at a party, and they put two glasses down, and they said, one is from Mendoza, one is from Cahors. What would your nose, your palate be looking for to differentiate between the two?
Well, I think the two things that are prominent there is you'll get a little more roundness, a little more depth, a little more maybe leather, a little more dark fruit, a little less red fruit, a little less rough tannin in the Argentine than you will in from the south of France. French winemaking will often emphasize a little bit more, because of their internal preferences, some of the tannin levels, whereas the tendency will be to round them a little bit in Argentina, and so those will be some of the most noticeable differences. I think qualitatively at the very top end, Malbec is ahead of virtually all samples coming out of Cahors, and certainly I'm partial on that, but I think I'd still say that, and so I'd expect higher quality right across the board, and also at the lower levels I'd expect very good quality too, but there are some wonderful examples coming out of the southwest of France.
Peter, because you're holding the mic right now, how often have you been tempted in your property in Mendoza to rip out 20% of your Malbec and plant Riesling?
Oh, an unfair question. It's not the right place for it. I love Riesling.
I know you do.
And you know that I'm a Riesling geek.
You thought about it?
No, I haven't.
No?
Although, at the point, you know, Ann and I used to bring Riesling when we come down. Like, we're going to be down there for 6 weeks. There's no way we're going to drink just Argentine Riesling. It's not going to happen, right? So we would bring Riesling from Ontario and from Sperling in BC and always some German stuff as well, and some Austrian. just to have it, because when you're down there and you're drinking the big, you know, the big reds and those reds for a while, you definitely want to have something special.
Okay, so you haven't been tempted. All right, I had to ask. And I'll go back to you. How hard is it? How do you guys balance winemaking? Because you have so many projects in Ontario, so many great, you know, your fingerprints are all over some of the highest end wines in certainly Niagara. How do you balance just time and schedule winemaking in Ontario and in Argentina?
Well, the beauty of it is that it's directly south of us. The time zone's actually the same and the seasons are exactly opposite, right?
Right.
So we can be, you know, sometimes it's tricky when we're thinking about harvest and talking about pruning in Argentina, but or bud break. But you know, you do over the years we've come to, you know, just you have these triggers in your mind and that's what tells you, you know, oh gee, I should be looking into this, or you know. And the beauty also of all of these devices we carry around, we have photos, we have, you know, exchanges, we have, you know, things like that, so you can always go back and look and say, oh, bud break last year was on, you know, it was in September. I did in fact do this just last week, and I looked and it was like, oh, 2 days difference, right?
So technology's made it easier for you guys than when you probably started.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we went through the pandemic where we couldn't be there. And so we really, you know, leaned heavy on all of those, you know, old records that we had from all the exchanges that we've done.
And really appreciated a fabulous team down there that we work with. And, you know, especially obviously during COVID.
Who's the better flyer between the two of you? Who is better on a plane?
Oh, I think we're pretty good.
Are you good?
Yeah, I think we're pretty good. It's a 10-hour flight from Toronto to Santiago, and it's usually an overnight flight. I don't mind, you know, sleeping in an uncomfortable chair. Peter doesn't fit quite as well in the chairs, but and doesn't sleep quite as much, but he mostly doesn't need as much sleep as I do anyway.
It's one of the good things about being 5'7" is I can handle any long flight. You know, came back from Japan, not a problem. Flew to New Zealand. It was long, but it was okay. All right, as we wrap this up, I want you to just promote a little bit more. By the time this podcast goes out, because I'm going to release this next, I have a couple ones that I've already done, but I'm going to push this one ahead because the release is coming out on October 4th. So by the time this comes out, the wine will be released for a couple days. But anyone listening to this right now, what should they expect on the nose, on the palate? Why do they need to go grab a bottle of 2018 Fasato?
Okay, so 2018 was, it was actually a really nice ripening fall in Argentina. So even though we had some cool weather at the start of the season, the vines had a nice, you know, moderate weather, but the grapes hung for a long time. So we have good intensity, good weight. Like, this wine is a total steal, but, you know, rich, dark color. It's we've got, you know, black fruit, but we have always got a little hints of herb and licorice on this wine. It's had barrel aging, but there isn't really an obvious wood note to it. You just get a lot of that depth and richness. There's some earthy notes, some stony kind of textures that come through, mulberries, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a beautiful wine. And you know, we're excited to have it in the market, even though it's, you know, Peter said it's painful. But actually, this will be the last time that this white label comes into Ontario, just because we're moving away from it, and we've had it, you know, we've sort of, you know, had that for our customers here, and we'll be moving to a new label that'll be at, you know, more like a $30 price point. So, but all of our wines, we have a selection of wines that are available through our agent, Crew Wine Merchants, and those will all be coming in October. So to get some Reserva or some of our regularly available to restaurants, old vines, they can be ordered through Crew Wine Merchants.
And by the way, for people listening, that's Crew, C-R-U. Just Google Crew Wine Merchants. You will find the website very, very easily. Guys, thank you so much for doing this. I'm going to tell you, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to grabbing a bottle. It's been ages since I bought Malbec. That's a blind spot for me. So I'm excited just to dip my toe back into it. First again, Peter, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, man. Pleasure to be here.
And Anne, thank you as well. Always lovely seeing you guys.
Cheers.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.